creatures we need are everywhere around us.
Hell yeah.
They're in every break of the game, every minute, every second. On this team, we fight for that itch. On this team, we tear ourselves and everyone else around us to pieces for that itch. We claw with our fingernails for that itch. Because we know when we add up all those inches, that's gonna make the difference between winning and losing.
Welcome to the Objective Secure Podcast. My name's Mike.
And I'm Emma.
And this is episode 12, Any Given Sunday. Yes, that is a football reference. And if you know the movie, congratulations. You've probably just heard it in our intro. But today we're going to talk all things team events. And we're going to cover...
We're not going to be covering anything about football, though.
No. But we are going to be covering team 40K events. And we're going to touch on a few of the different team events, actually. But we're going to primarily be focusing on the 40K events that happen here in Australia and around the world. And we're going to cover some of the stuff that you need to do and think about when you're putting a team together and how you can see the best results out of your team and also what the differences are across the different formats from around the world. So we're going to cover some quick news and give you a bit of a heads up on the primary topic. But why don't we just dive straight into it? So what's been happening in Perth since our last podcast?
So, objective secured. We ran our first Age of Sigmar event for the year.
Yeah, Eight Lamentations. It was one day, 1,250 points plus a free champion of one of the eight realms. And we had 32 sign up and 30 attend, which was awesome to see. And
it's a really quiet room.
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, they played five games. It was like First Blood. It was full on for the guys. But what was really cool was the standard of hobby has gone up in the Age of Sigmar community. There was, you know, a very high percentage of them that were painted, which was great. And then, you know, we've got different players winning the events as well, which was great.
Yeah, we had, was it 12 came down from Joondalup to play?
Yeah, yeah, it was a huge percentage of guys. It was, it's about an hour drive from the Joondalup Games Workshop store, and it was the store manager and a bunch of his regulars who came down, and they took away a bunch of the prizes.
Which is... Probably because they made up almost 50% of their player pool. So, but good. We really appreciate the guys coming.
Yeah, and congratulations to Kurgan for winning overall there as well. I think he was more surprised than anyone else in the room. But he deserved it. So, yeah, congratulations to him and to all the other winners. We also had Crags run their latest or first 40K event for 2018, Unending Battle Lines, which was, what, just over a week ago now at the time of this recording?
Yes, yep.
And I think they ended up with 30-something players as well, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. It's one of the biggest 40K events they've had for a little while now, which is great.
Yep, and congrats to Dave for taking out the win for that one.
Yeah, Sly Dave, we actually recorded a game, and if I can get the clips to all work, then you'll see that on YouTube very shortly.
Yeah, a few audio issues and technical issues that
we're getting better at that.
Working through, yeah.
And if you haven't seen it yet, jump on our YouTube page. The first game with local hobbyist Galen was also published this week.
Yep.
With her Death Guard and My Sisters of Battle, which was awesome. And as one of our viewers pointed out, the Aussie summer has managed to bring a fly into the house and land itself on the camera partway through the game. So just blessing Nurgle's presence on the table. Didn't help, they lost, but spoiler alert. But yeah, so go and check out the video.
Maybe they
as well.
Won and you're trying to throw them.
But look, I mean, we've still got a bunch of events coming up as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Most recent thing that you attended, you went down to the Games Workshop birthday event yesterday as well, down in, well, it was yesterday when we were recording this.
Yeah, in Fremantle. That was the 24th and 25th of February.
Yeah.
It was one of the, now I can't say this for certain, but I believe it was one of the last, if not the last place you could get the Primaris Captain with Power Fist and Plasma Pistol, because rumour has it they're going to be changing that store birthday model each year.
Oh, awesome.
So that could very well have been the last opportunity to buy one.
So, if you missed out, Sucks to be you.
Yeah, you're not getting mine. But no, so Mitch is a big supporter of ours. He comes to a lot of our events, and he's always pitching in and promoting. So I know he's he had a massive weekend, and everyone looked like they were having fun. They ran 40K on Saturday and Age of Sigmar on Sunday.
Event.
Yeah.
Was it doubles event both days?
Both days.
Oh, awesome.
So like 16 or 20 players each day, which was great. So, yeah. And then we've got Linebreaker 40K in about 3.5 weeks' time. And then a month later, we've got WATC, the West Australian Team Challenge, which is kind of what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, so we covered a lot about the travelling for events in our last podcast,
yeah,
which obviously links in with Linebreaker, and today we're going to be talking about team events.
Yeah, so you know, we're going to start with just some brief information about the different events, and then in the main segment, we'll start covering some of the real nitty-gritty of the team events. So...
We did cover a little bit around this very, very briefly in the Facebook Live that we did last Wednesday.
Yeah.
And we just thought that there's so much to cover in it that we, I guess, we'll do something a little bit more in depth and give it a bit more.
So we'll start with what all the acronyms are and some of the little bit of the history. We're not going to bore you with too much of it. And then we're going to dive straight into it. So WATC, the West Australian Team Challenge, is something that Emma and I started. This is our third year in April, and its format hasn't really changed. We went from 4 players in the first year. We're now doing 6 players like we did last year.
Mm-hmm.
And then that format is loosely based off the ANZTC, the Australia-New Zealand Team Challenge.
Which up until very recently was the ATC.
Yep.
So it has had a rename to reflect the fact
that New Zealand's actually attending for 2018.
Which is fantastic. We'll see them at show later on in the year.
If you have been living under a rock, we won the bid for the ANZTC to come to Perth for 2018. It's the 8th year it's been running.
The first year that it's been to WA.
It is. So that's really cool. We're going to have, I'm hoping, 8 teams. 6 teams minimum, but 8 teams is a definite possibility at the moment, of 8 players. And then the next step up from the ANZTC is the ETC, which is the European Team Championships, or Challenge, I forget which one it is now. It's a bit of a weird one to have as European Team Challenge, because they've got teams that come from Canada, from the US, from Australia, from parts of Asia. It's no longer European. I don't know why the name has stuck around for as long as it has. I mean, Australia first participated back in 2012 when I went over with Diffie and a few of the boys from the East Coast and a couple of the other WA locals as well.
It's European Team Championship.
There you go.
Just did a quick Google.
And I know that America had been competing the prior 2 or 3 years before we went, which means that... you know, it had stopped being European long before Australia turned up. So hopefully they'll update that at some point. And then the other one that you might see lurking around is the WTC, which we're not going to touch on too much here. It's the World Team Championships for War Machine and Hordes.
And there is also the ATC, which is the American Team Championship. American Team Challenge. Oh, Championship Challenge. It's one of those.
Which is their 40K version. And I should point out the ETC also does some fantasy, and they did do Flames of War. I don't know if they're still doing Flames of War
as
well.
And there's a rumour as to whether or not Bolt Action is going to be happening there this year as well.
Cool. Now, we're going to focus on today for the WATC, the ANZTC and the ETC, because those three team events kind of cross-pollinate each other with players, but also feed each other's rulings and format.
They're also the ones that we're most familiar with.
So the American version of the team event is different, but since we're Aussies, we're going to talk about the ones that we know. So,
just as a total off-topic type thing, when we were discussing the plan for this episode, we were talking about what the history was, and I was like, "Ugh, I don't care about dates. I don't care about, you know, how long it's been running." What I'd really love to know is, how did the ETC get started? How do you get a group of people from countries all over Europe to come together and play in, you know, one particular spot in the middle of a school oval in a tent kind of thing? And we haven't been able to find out any information around that. So if anybody is listening, does actually have any of the information around how it all got started or who was behind that and any of the stories that go with that, then we'd really like to hear about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're fortunate that Joshua Diffie in Victoria is a good friend of mine, and he helped launch the Australian version of the ETC. So we do have access to someone who's got all the history, which is why we know this is the eighth year. We know what the formats have been. I've been to three of them as the captain for WA, and WA's attended every single one of them since its inception, which is awesome.
Yeah, and I think that we sort of have the idea around how the ATC came about, in that Australia couldn't actually get to the ETC.
Yeah, it did take a few
years. And trying
to
replicate that kind of system over here and talking to some of the key players in the different states to make that happen.
Well, when the distances from going, say, from Perth to Sydney to play ATC are further than travelling from Spain to Croatia, or, you know, those sorts of flights, we actually travel a long way for our ATC events. And
we do, but we don't have the language barriers that there are.
That is true.
So
essentially, all these formats are fairly similar in that they share a team, 6 to 8 players. WATC only uses 6, but the ETC and the ANZTC are 8 players. And they all get together and they play 8 games, well, depending on how many players, of course. They play games against an opposing team, and the results are all then added together, and the team, generally speaking, the team with the most points across those 6 or 8 games wins.
Yeah, so it's team against team rather than individual.
Yeah, the individual results are less important other than what they score for the actual team. Yeah. So the ETC uses, and it's been going the longest, it uses a few different scoring matrices and things to work that out, which we'll cover in the main topic in a minute. But the core of it is, it's a group of people who get together with different armies, because you're not allowed to duplicate factions. And they we play 4, 5, 6 games, depending on which event and which format. And at the end of it, there's a winner, hopefully. Probably.
Well, I think there's been a winner every year so far, so yeah.
it's one of those weird ones as well, that there's only a handful of us in WA who've actually been to all 3 of these events. So I'm fortunate to have been to WATC the last 3 years that we've run it. Mm-hmm. I attended the ANZTC for 2014, 15 and 16. Mm-hmm. And then had to choose between that and LVO in 2017, and chose LVO. And then 2018, and we're obviously running it, so I can't play this year either, which is a bummer. And then I went to ETC in 2012 as part of the first Australian team.
Yeah.
And when you actually go back and look at who's actually been to all 3 of those events, there's only, I think, 3 of us in Perth.
Can I only think of 3?
There's myself, Tom, and Pete. So both of whom are on the ATC team for this year. So it's a very small pool of WA players who've attended all 3 of those events. And when you actually look at who's attended an ETC, the pool is probably only, if it's 2 dozen players, I'd be surprised.
WA players?
No, just in general. In general. I mean, the WA players number just the 3 of us, I believe. Mm-hmm. Although Brett in Queensland gets an honorary nod as a WA boy.
No, he was a Queenslander when he went.
It was just after he moved to Queensland. He's still a WA boy for that one.
I think he's still lived longer in WA than he has in Queensland, so we can still claim he's one of our own.
Exactly. So, look, we're going to go into a very lengthy conversation around differences and stuff you need to think about for team prep and all that sort of stuff in a second. But
lengthy, while trying to limit it to 45 minutes at an absolute max.
I think if we stop now, we'll get about 50 minutes. We'll see how we go. But we'll take a quick break, and then you can settle in for our epic conversation around team events and how to prepare for them.
It'll be epic in length, not necessarily skill, but yeah.
We'll be back in a sec. So we've kept the introduction fairly brief because this is a very lengthy topic, and I don't even know if we're going to be able to cover it all in this one sitting, so we'll see how we go. Let's talk team events, and specifically those that follow the ETC format, so the WATC, the ANZTC, and the ETC, obviously.
Yeah, so we're going to start out by just talking about how they're similar.
Yep.
And then move on to how they're different, and then prepping for those events.
Yeah, so like we mentioned in the opener, they are team events of 6 to 8 players. All of them share that common characteristic of 6 to 8 players. WATC only goes 6 just purely because it's a one-day event. And getting 8 players and all the rest of it together, let alone playing all those extra games, is a challenge in one day. So we restrict it to six players for WATC, but the other two play eight. And you also can have a non-playing captain, I should add, for all three of those events.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that non-playing captain is what it literally says on the tin. It's an extra player who can fill in. So,
but that's probably further down in my notes, but worth pointing out that just because it's a non-playing captain doesn't necessarily mean that that captain won't play.
Yeah. So we that when you submit a list for lists for any of these events, you submit a team of eight lists, not necessarily with eight players attached to it.
Well, no, you submit a team of eight players and you submit eight lists.
Yes.
The players are not attached to any of those lists.
Yeah, so it is completely possible for players to mid-event, not mid-game, but mid-event they can swap armies and play different armies.
Hmm.
Now, tactically speaking, I don't see too many benefits for doing that. However, in this particular case with a non-playing captain, it does give you that opportunity if a player is sick, injured, hungover, or any other...
Family emergencies.
Yep. Anything like that. It means that you've still got another player that can step in and play. In my experience, it's only, generally speaking, it's the host nation that tends to bring those extra players along. Occasionally, you get them coming along as partners or... When I went to ETC, there were a couple of teams which had coaches, which were essentially the ninth player. And some of them were actual active players, and some of them were there for moral support, and some of them were there to kick the players up the butts when they weren't doing the right thing.
Hmm.
I still have vivid memories of the Greek team in that regard, where she was awesome. She was, I can't think of her name now, but she, their female coach kicked their butts when they made dumb decisions. It was amazing. She was awesome. So... The ninth player or the seventh player for WATC, not that I think we'll get many for WATC.
We are talking to the Young Bloods team to suggest that they may have a non-playing captain as well. But obviously any team that's coming to WATC is able to have a non-playing captain. So earlier I said that you submit a list of eight players. Obviously, if you've got a non-playing captain, then you'd be submitting a list of nine players.
Yeah, or seven for WATC.
Yeah, sorry.
So on top of that, let's move on to the next part, which is the way that you're limited in selecting armies.
And this is similar across all three of those two events in that they all have that same restriction.
Yeah, there's little nuances to how it's actually applied for each one of them, but in a nutshell, you essentially can't duplicate detachments. You can't duplicate factions. So by that I mean once one player uses a faction keyword... no other player can use that faction keyword. That's no other list can use that faction keyword. So, for example, if you were playing a Craftworld Elder army, your faction keyword would be, I think it's Asurian, which is the Games Workshop word for Craftworld Elder. So that's the keyword that your army would use. And then once you've used that, no one else in the team can use it, but you can use it as much as you like within the detachment limits of the event.
Yeah, so every model in detachment must... share a faction keyword. All detachments must share a faction keyword, but this can actually significantly impact on the teams and faction choices for lists across the whole team.
Yeah, because it means that there's some models that that cross over with different factions, and there's different keywords that can impact when you take one model, you might take another one off the table for someone else. So things like my best example is Saint Celestine. Now, if you're not familiar with her and you play 40K, where have you been? But essentially, she has Astra Militarum and the Adeptus Sororitas, or I can't think what the actual right keyword for her is, but essentially it's the Sisters of Battle keyword and the Imperial Guard keyword, which means that if you put her on the table at any point, you're using those two faction keywords. So if you want to run Saint Celestine and a Sisters of Battle army, you're not running Imperial Guard. You're not running the Astra Militarum because you've already used that keyword. And vice versa, if you put her into an Imperial Guard army, then you can't use the Sisters of Battle army.
You can't, or other team members can't?
Other team members can't.
Yeah, so you can.
Oh, yeah,
if
you
that's,
can.
Yeah, but your other team members can't.
Yeah, yeah, you as in the team colloquially.
Yeah, I think we might need to distinguish between you and team. And so that's one of the things that we were talking about. So Mike was just talking about the Elder. If you're choosing to use three different factions of Elder, then that means that the rest of your team can't access
any
those factions at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess it's making sure that you're aware that the choices you make are going to significantly impact on the choices that the other players in your team can make as well.
Yeah, and that'll also come back to things like Reboot Gilliman from the Ultramarines, who's got a lot of Imperial buffs that impact any Imperial army. If you want to put him into your Astra Militarum army, then no one else is using Space Marines, because you've just used the Adeptus Astartes keyword by putting Gilliman in a detachment into that Astra Militarum army. So what you end up seeing is far less soup and far more mono or maybe dual faction armies. They certainly hark back more to the times of 6th and 7th ed or even 5th ed prior to Allies, because you tend to end up in a situation where you'll get one or two soup armies and then everyone else kind of ends up being single or maybe double faction.
So for people who are perhaps newer to talking about armies and don't know what a soup army is, do you want to just very quickly cover that?
Yeah, so a soup army is essentially when you take lots and lots and lots of different codexes and use bits out of each of them in your army. So one of the best known ones at the moment is the LVO winner, Nick, and likewise Jeremy, who won, I think it was Jeremy, who won CanCon.
So Nick had the two detachments of Craft World and the one detachment of Inari?
Yes, and I believe from memory, Nick's Inari section also had Dark Elder inside it as well.
Yeah, and so the Inari is slightly different in that it means you can pick from all of the Eldar codexes.
Yeah, so essentially that's probably one of the best ones, because it utilizes all the Craftworld rules by taking a pure Craftworld detachment, but then picks up all of those rules and wraps it into the Inari, because a lot of them cross over with keywords. So it's a great way of buffing things that probably shouldn't get benefits, which I'm assuming will get fixed in a future FAQ. And likewise, a lot of the, like I've just mentioned with Reboot Gilliman, a lot of those Imperial soup armies work with Gilliman standing in the middle of it with his 6-inch auras that benefit everyone within that distance. The new Adeptus Custodes have a couple of banners that have the similar effects, where it's just any friendly Imperial model within X many inches gains these benefits. So as soon as you start combining those models into other armies, you start limiting what the rest of the team can take.
Yeah, so soup army basically means where you pick and choose the best bits from...
Think of it as a vegetable soup. The broth is the base of the list, and then you're throwing in
the bits and pieces,
the carrots and the celery and all the other bits and pieces to make up the flavour of the soup. And in some cases they work and they're awesome, and in other cases they're terrible.
Yeah.
So the soup army describes that. It describes the ability to mix and match any ingredient you like and make it either good or dreadful.
And the idea is obviously to make it a nice, strong, well-rounded, solid army. And the other thing with the fact that you can't double up in this event, it does mean that there's no double up for special characters either, because they're obviously linked to keywords.
Yeah, exactly. So one, I've seen some people try and argue, again, with things like Saint Celestine, where she has multiple keywords, that you could argue that you're using one keyword and not the other, and that's just not cricket. So you can't...
we told you we wouldn't be talking about football, but apparently we're going to slip some cricket in there.
So all of the unique characters remain unique. One per army essentially means one per team, because like Emma's just mentioned, the keywords essentially limit those really quickly. So, you're not going to see teams of 6 to 8 with Eldrad Ulthran in every army and, those sorts of things happening. You're not even going to see two Eldar armies essentially.
Yeah, so we were just kind of... It came up in the Facebook Live video we did as to why did we actually make this decision. And was it just because we're following the way that ETC does it and ANZTC do it? But really, when it comes down to it, the reason that we've made the decision that the keywords can only be limited to one list per army, one list per team, is the intention is that you do end up with varied lists and more balanced lists, and also being really aware that doing it this way, the team has to work as a team and has to support each other.
Oh, look, there'd be nothing worse than rocking up to a team event and having 6 guys playing the exact same Eldar army or the exact same Space Marine army, just copy-pasted.
Well, I think, though, that when you do that, it's not necessarily a team event. It becomes 6 individuals playing, whereas this way, you actually really have to consider the balance of your team and how one list affects every other list that that team's able to write.
Yeah, look, I mean, it certainly gets more and more difficult the more players you throw into a team as well. I mean, at six players, I think there's some 30-odd options for...
I think we saw 33.
I want to say 33, of various codexes and factions that are currently available. I'm just going to bring the website up while we chat and I'll see if I can count them. But when you actually start getting down to it, if you go, cool, I've got one player playing Tau, one player with Tyranids, and you know, by extension, potentially Gene Stealer Cult, you've got one Eldar player potentially taking three of those, you've got a Space Marine player, you've got a Chaos player, you've got one more slot there, whether that's Tau, Necrons, one of the specialist Space Marines like Dark Angels, Blood Angels, Space Wolves, or anything like that, and you've still got a few support elements there that you can tie into those Imperial and Chaos armies by adding Demons or by adding Imperial Guard or whatever it happens to be. When you hit eight players, it gets far more complicated.
And that's because, obviously, with the eight players where you have those base codexes to choose from, and you're kind of spreading that out.
Yeah, so I'm just going to bring up the list here. So, according to this, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13... 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28. There's 28 listed.
The number of today is 28.
The funny thing is there that this doesn't even reflect it right. This is just how they've grouped it on the website.
Mm.
So the as an example, the Imperial Knights tab that they've got on the Games Workshop website, there are two different faction keywords for Imperial Knights, one in the AdMech book and one in the index, which are two distinct factions.
Mm.
The Inquisition has a couple of different variations there. I think the Adeptus Ministorum is the Sisters of Battle keyword these days. And within that, that has multiple different things that you can throw into it as well. So once you actually start digging through these factions, the 28 probably becomes 30-something by the time you split them all up properly. But at eight players, you'd be surprised at how quickly they disappear because... you know, someone says, oh, cool, I want to take... Chaos is a great example. It's always a hot topic for players because someone will say, okay, I want to take Chaos. Okay, what Chaos? Oh, I want to take Heretic Astartes because I want to run Alpha Legion. But I also need to use Magus the Red and Demons. And all of a sudden, you've just used Thousand Suns, Demons, and the core Chaos Space Marines. You've just used three books in the space of one army list. And what that's then done is it's meant that if you want to run Death Guard, you've got no option other than to run pure Death Guard. Now, at that stage...
You have to look at whether or not are you narrowing the field for your teammates
too far.
Too much.
Yeah. I mean, you've got Renegade Knights as well, I suppose. But at the end of the day, the point is that you are hacking into the amount of available codexes. Now, the other part to consider with this is we only allow two detachments at WATC because of the smaller points value.
Mm-hmm.
You get three at ETC and ANZTC. Now, most of the benefits you get from keeping to a single faction keyword come from a full detachment of that single faction keyword. Well, doing it with two detachments is actually really hard to do a soup army because as soon as you throw one model in that isn't a pure detachment, so for example, throwing an Harlequin Solitaire into a Craftworld detachment, they share the Eldari keyword, so that's fine, that's a legal format, but now you lose all your Craftworld benefits because it's not a pure Craftworld detachment.
Yeah.
So I think WATC will probably lend itself to far more mono codex builds because you've only got two detachments to work with and you lose so much when you do try and cross-pollinate the books. So it'll be interesting to see what lists we do actually get.
Yeah, definitely.
But
I think we sort of covered some of the similarities there. So should we move on to some of the differences between them? Apart from the fact, obviously, WATC has six players, not eight, which ANZTC and ETC have.
Yeah, like we've mentioned, the six players for WATC is a logistics-driven reason more than anything else. Getting a haul for 2 days is hard, and getting teams of eight together when they're friends is you know, not necessarily an easy thing to do.
I think it's easy to get the team together, but getting a team of eight players together that all play different lists...
That's what I was sort of hinting
tricky,
at.
Tricky, yeah.
And we tried it with four players the first year as an effort just to kind of give a taste for the format. The problem is with four players, the matchup process essentially becomes... whoever wins the first dice roll picks three of the four matchups.
Yeah.
Whereas with six players, there's a little bit of variation there. And if you want to check out the matchup process, in the show notes is a link to the YouTube video we did for the 2017 event, so you can follow along for the six-player event.
We're going to be talking about that later on as well.
Yeah, and the ANZ and the ETC both use the same matchup process anyway, just with two extra players.
So one of the differences between WATC, ANZTC, the differences between those and the ETC is that ETC doesn't allow Forge World.
Yeah, it's one that I know they vote on. They voted on for 2018.
With the Captain's Council.
Yeah. And it was a no, which, I don't know, it feels a little bit backwards to me. I know that there's always been a hang-up for Forge World, though.
I think possibly before Forge World was written into some of the Games Workshop publications, I can see a reason for being able to make that decision.
I suppose the tipping point for me was with Chapter Approved 2017, which is a Games Workshop publication put on the shelves in Games Workshop stores, and it included updates for Forge World.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the tipping point of, oh, hang on a minute, now we're recognising that it is a standard product line, you have to mail order it. It's not something we stock in stores. So the choice to ban it, in Europe in particular, was one that I kind of scratched my head at a little bit and went, oh, okay, because that's going to fundamentally change the way you build armies.
For some armies.
For some.
Yeah. But I suppose the reason that we... Well, the reason that you're saying that you scratch your head a little bit about it is because, you know, does it become a point of, well, where do we draw the line?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
For some of these things, okay, Forge World doesn't seem balanced, but at the moment there are some other models that seem...
Dark Reapers.
seem unbalanced. So do we say, okay, well, we're not prepared to have those in there because they don't seem balanced? You know, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the Forge World stuff is all officially published documentation. It's now recognized in the main rule books and everything like that. If you start banning all of Forge World just because it's got the name Forge World attached to it, that's not the right reason to do it. If they're overpowered, well, then you should be making a list of everything that's overpowered, and at which point you have...
But who's defining overpower?
Yeah, it's an impossible line to draw. So certainly over the last few years, Forge World's got better and better and better. The rules for most Forge World units these days are fundamentally worse than anything you get in a codex. I mean, my Elder Army, I've got plenty of the Forge World toys, and most of them are overpriced and underpowered compared to what you get in the normal book.
Yeah, which I think is why banning Forge World can significantly affect some armies but not others. So if you were taking an Eldar army, you wouldn't necessarily, well, you probably wouldn't take anything Forge World over Standard Codex.
No, you're taking it because you like the model or you like the aesthetic or you've got some sort of niche trick with it that only works in certain situations with that one model, which isn't necessarily a good reason to take it.
Whereas Space Marines would generally want to take the Forge World Fire Raptor.
Yeah, the Fire Raptor is one that we saw, I think it ended up 10th or very close to 10th at LVO with a trio of them and Reboot Gilliman giving them all their rerolls. And anyone who's faced two or three of these with those rerolls, it's absolutely horrific. They're 360, 370-ish points a plane though, so by the time you pay for three of them and Gilliman, you're out close on 1,300 points. So there's not much left to support it. So it is a trick.
It's that
army.
Balance.
It is a if you can shoot down the planes, you win. If you can't shoot down the planes, you lose.
Yeah.
In a nutshell. But that does skew the way you potentially build them. It does take a decent player to play that army though, because of the way flyers move, but that's another topic.
Yeah.
So yeah, look, there are certainly going to be armies that are skewed because they can't take those things. But I don't necessarily think it's not going to be a negative impact on ETC. It's just going to
create... It's just a difference.
It's going to create a different playing field, that's all.
Yeah.
We keep Forge World because I like my toys.
We keep Forge World because it's not up to us to make decisions on what's overpowered.
I like my toys.
If it's listed in a publication, it's not up to us
to decide. You can take the high ground. I like my toys.
Remember we had that discussion around the positive and... Yeah. Anyway.
I like my toys.
So another difference between them... Number of games. So ETC plays 6 games, 4 hours a game over 3 days.
Yeah, including the matchup process. You basically play one in the morning, have lunch, play one in the afternoon, and then go out.
Yeah, lots of drinking.
Yeah. The ETC, the whole event, is actually about 5 or 6 days long because they do a singles event in the lead up to the team event. And then you've got the three... Well, when I went, it was 3 team events running concurrently. So there was probably over 1,000 players in that one venue playing the 3 different game systems, which was really cool.
Yeah.
But I think the allowance for that 4 hours is partly to do with language, partly to do with some of the complexity and the high level of play. It's also to ensure that everyone actually finishes their games, because there's nothing worse than having a game go, you know, 3 hours and then only get to turn 2.
Especially if you've travelled from the other side of the world.
Absolutely.
To play 2 turns of a game.
In 4 hours, yeah, that'd suck.
ATC does 5 or 6 games, and that's dependent on the number of teams that attend, and that's over 2 days?
Yeah. So in the last couple of years, it's only been 6 teams, so obviously you can't play yourself, and there's only five opponents, so you play everyone.
Oh, yeah, good point.
when you go to 8 teams, you'll get 6 games, and you'll skip one of the 8, because obviously, again, you can't play yourself, and there's only 6 games.
And you can't have an uneven number of teams.
It's not possible. So we generally try and stretch the time out a little bit for ATC. Certainly, we're going to be aiming for 3-hour game, ANZTC. I've got to break that habit.
Yeah.
We're going to try and be stretching that out to 3-hour games for 2018 if we possibly can.
Which is going to mean a heck of a long day for the players.
It is going
to
be a long day.
That's 9 hours just playing, so we're looking at 10.5 hours.
Yeah. So it's going to be a long day for them.
That's nasty.
So they're going to be starting nice and early, and they're going to be finishing, I'm guessing it'll probably be 8 till 6, give or take.
Oh, see, 8 till 6 doesn't sound as bad as saying 10.5 hours,
no,
does
it?
Yeah.
But at least we've got a licensed venue for ATC as well, so they will be able to grab lunch and have a pint or two while they play and relax.
Yeah.
So, and then WATC?
WATC, 4 games, 1 day, and they're just 2-hour rounds. We do have a lower points level for that one, though.
Yeah, they're only 1,500
points
for WATC, and only just 2 detachments, not 3.
And that one is also licensed venue with food and...
Yeah, so we try and make sure that the breaks, you actually have that opportunity without having to leave the venue. Just make sure that you're not wasting too much time out and about trying to find food, because we've had that in the past where people have gone out and spent 3 hours trying to find food and all sorts of silliness.
Yeah.
So
the differences there, obviously, different points levels, different number of days, different round lengths. And the missions is a funny one. They all differ, but they all have the same kind of structure to them.
Yeah, they're what I call complex missions. So they combine Eternal War, Maelstrom, and then kill points.
Yep.
They're not called kill points in 8th edition. They're called something else, but it's kill points. It's 1 point for every enemy unit you blow up.
Yeah. And so the results from those are combined and used on the results of those are combined and used on the differential chart to come up with the results.
Yeah, so the differential chart is one that was hands up stolen from ETC, and it essentially compares the two scores and then works out the differential, which then allocates points out of 20, which means that every player has the same potential total score.
Yeah, it's giving an even field.
Yeah, it just means you can't have blowouts with massive points wins and things like that, which is something that we've done in WA since we started running events.
Yeah, definitely.
And,
it's near on 3 years now.
3 years, yeah.
Wow.
So it's a really good format. It means that you've got fixed goalposts to aim for, particularly in a team event. You don't want to have a goalpost to aim and then have like the first game with a massive blowout, which is just unrecoverable.
Yeah.
So losing one game in a team event isn't the end of the world. Losing 5 of them.
It's going to be tricky to come back from.
Yes, probably the end of the games.
But the missions are, you know, they're different across all 3 of those events, potentially.
Yeah, we used to just use the ETC missions back through sort of 5th, 6th, 7th editions because we only had so many missions available in the pool. Now, because we've now got 12 Eternal War and 12 Maelstrom missions, there's an opportunity to start mixing and matching, and, you know, instead of having 36 combinations, you've now got 144 combinations of missions.
Mm.
So there's plenty of opportunity there to make each event unique with its combination of missions while retaining the same format.
Yeah, and those missions really can help you dictate how you build your armies.
Yeah, not only how you build your armies, but how you do your matchups, and there's a whole raft of changes, you know, deployment zones or player factor as well, and yeah, they're very important to understand before you actually get into anything like playing one of the games.
Yeah, which is a nice little segue into prepping for a team event.
Yeah, look, the prep for team events is a weird one because unlike single player, obviously you have to think about people other than yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, you first of all, obviously you've got to, just as a team, decide who's taking what faction keywords, because ultimately that's the single biggest crutch that you have to overcome as a team. So like we mentioned earlier, 6 players don't struggle with it too much most of the time. But if you only play one army, and a few of the WATC players will probably have that issue where you've got 2 guys who only play Eldar or only play Space Marines, you've then got to come up with a plan B, either someone making a new army or borrowing an army, or using a different keyword. Space Marines, it's fairly easy to get around by just simply using like a Dark Angels keyword or a Blood Angels keyword instead of your standard ones.
And so with the Young Bloods, that was an issue for those guys. There were two of them who were playing the same.
Yeah, both of them had standard Ultramarines, Space Marines.
Yeah, and so what were the workarounds for that?
The first suggestion was, getting them to essentially run Blood Angels or Dark Angels using those keywords instead.
Mm.
That can sometimes be a barrier for people, though, because it does mean getting another codex for something that they're probably not going to use again. But a lot of the time it's possible to borrow those and, you know...
It's what community's all about.
Yeah, let's go with that. So that's probably the first thing you need to decide as a team is who's taking what keywords.
Yeah, and once you've chosen your factions, look at how you're going to score some points.
Yeah, you have to think about that when you're building your army, particularly with these complex missions, because unlike a lot of the other formats that happen around the world, you've got three different ways of scoring points, and you don't necessarily need to be good at all of them.
Mm.
If you want to score kill points, you need to be good at killing things. If you want to score Maelstrom, you have to be mobile enough to move about the table to get to those objective points. And if you want to score the Eternals, you just have to be durable enough to be there at the end of the game
in
bigger numbers than the opponent.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily need to build for all three of them. Building for Eternal or Maelstrom is probably what I'd suggest most players do, is pick one of those two things to excel at, and then make sure you can kill things. Because that inevitably is something that will happen in its nature across the game and will also make your other objectives easier to score. I find that the Maelstrom, some of the formats around the world will limit how Maelstrom works, how many cards you can score, how many you draw, which cards can and can't be used. I find that in the unrestricted ones, which is what we tend to play, you actually run a little bit of a risk with Maelstrom because it becomes the luck of the draw on the cards. If the mission lets you cycle through the deck quite quickly, it's not so bad.
Mm.
But it can be a risk for players to take if they go, you know what, I'm going to focus on scoring points every round. What that will do for you is obviously you can keep the margin of win or loss closer, whereas you might be losing the game and then get to the end of it and go, oh, wow, I hold all the objectives and now all of a sudden win by 15 points because of the Eternal War mission. That requires a different type of planning for the game.
Yeah, yeah. Going back to something that you said sort of earlier in that little information piece was, working. If you're going to kill things, what are you going to kill? How are you going to do that? So, and I guess an interesting thing to think about is what archetypes are you strong against and what are you weak against? But not only you as a player, but do you have an even spread in your team?
Yeah, the team dynamic's really important because if you don't consider... look, in a very basic format you can think about is infantry versus vehicles. Vehicles isn't the right word these days. Big monster things.
Little toys and big toys?
little bad guys and big bad guys. You know, if you're facing 100 Imperial Guardsmen in one list and 100 Tyranid Gaunts in another list and... 100 Genestealer Colts in the next one and 100 Orcs in the next one, then you've got this huge wall of infantry, and if your entire team kills infantry really well, that's going to be a great round for you.
However...
But if your opponent across the table is a wall of Mechanized Guard, a wall of Mechanized Eldar, a wall of Mechanized Space Marines, a wall of Mechanized Chaos Space Marines, and you've got nothing but anti-infantry guns, you're going to have a bad day.
Mm.
So the dynamics and balance of the team is also important, because while those skew lists can win you rounds because your opponents just get to the table and go, oh god, there's four of those, oh, we can't deal with them, they can also lose you rounds when you show up and go,
if you're the one that
yeah. So the balance lists I always find tend to work better than going full-blown crazy into one aspect of the game.
And it can work well to have one or two skewed army lists.
I think at six players, having one or maybe two is probably the limit. At eight players, you can afford to have two. But I think those skew lists still need to have a capable player there so that if they don't get the match they want...
They can still come out with some points.
Yeah, you don't want to be giving away 20 points to your opponent just because you've got a bad matchup, if you can help it.
And, you know, really, well-rounded armies and a well-rounded team is going to do better than eight skewed.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the way the matchup process works now, in the past where it was essentially I put an army list up, then you pick one that gets to play it from your team, and then you put one up, and then I get to pick one that plays it. Yeah. That did create a situation of essentially swords and shields, where you would make a team up that was half stabby, killy, winny, and half denial, where it wouldn't give up a lot of points.
But now it's you put one team up and I put two up,
and then
you
I get to pick which of those two. So if you've got a very skewed list that can only kill infantry and you put them forward and I put two tank lists up, well, you've got two bad choices at that stage. Yeah. So the matchup process is, I suppose, less impactful for some teams and more impactful for others, depending on how you structure your team.
Yeah, and I guess with well-rounded armies, there's no need to shield them from matchups that they can't win.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, if you do get a bad matchup, the goal has to be, oh, I'm not just going to give up and give you 20 points. You've still got to have a plan. But if you've got a team of players who kind of go, well, we're not going to get 20-0 blowouts, but we're also not going to get 20-0 losses, you've still got good odds of winning the round. Because ultimately, if you have a six-player event...
No, that's later on. Stick to the notes. This is why we write notes, remember? So back to thinking about
I'm not going to comment about which podcast you remind me of right now.
Back to thinking about how you can score points.
Scoring points.
Yeah.
What am I scoring points on?
How can you minimize the kill points that you give up?
Okay, so that comes back to army building. So obviously your deployment window is important, how many drops you have to secure that plus one to go first. Minimizing the drops will also help you minimize your kill points. The downside to that, of course, is minimizing your board control because you have less units to control objectives late game and also to score maelstrom points during the game. So you've got to weigh that balance up as to exactly how many things you want to include. So I'm building a tau army at the moment, and one list building process I went through was, oh my god, I can run so many units of four drones. I can deep strike them. I can take all these objectives with them. This is amazing. Oh my god, there's 30 something kill points. Oh, that's not so great. And they're units of four models with one wound and a 4+ save. They're going to die in droves. So while I might score 1 point for deep striking them onto an objective, I'm almost certainly going to hand that point straight back to my opponent.
Yeah.
And it's something that I know that the ANZTC does, I think the ETC does as well, which is a kill point cap, in that the differential worth of points that you get is capped out at either 8 or 10 points, and that then ties into a cap on how many maelstrom cards you can score as the balancing point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily agree with either of those caps. It's one of the reasons why we don't run them.
We don't run caps, yep.
Partly because at one point there, they were capping the kill points at 8 and then capping the maelstrom cards at 2 per turn,
yep.
Which actually meant you could score more points off maelstrom than you could off kill points.
Yeah.
So it was more advantageous to go, you know what, I'm going to have 30 units. I'm going to accept the fact that in terms of working out a differential, I'm going to give up 8 points,
yeah.
But I still have the potential to score more than those 8 points by just spamming units.
Yeah.
And the flip side of that, of course, is that if you limit the maelstrom cards still to 2 per turn, but remove the kill point cap, you still end up with roughly an equal number. So certainly it seemed to work so well so far for the WA events. Whether that ever changes nationally or internationally is another matter entirely. But it seems to work okay here.
Yeah, so I guess other ways that you've talked about for ways that you're going to score points, your mobility for the Maelstrom and your staying power for the Eternal War. And this one is a touchy subject maybe, but potentially it's a good idea to read the player's pack before the event. It's a good idea to actually read the missions before the event, and possibly even reading the missions and using those missions to help guide how you build your army list.
Yeah. In a single player event, I did it when I went to Crags a couple of weeks ago for Unending Battle Lines. I wrote a list. I didn't even look at the missions and went, "Wee, I'm just going to go and play." Mm. And when it's only my result on the line, if I choose to do that, then I live with the results and the consequences.
Yeah, you didn't do very well, did you?
I did all right.
Yeah.
I'd never played a game with Tau before that day.
Yeah, you were a disgrace.
I finished 10th.
I almost didn't let you back in at home. 10th. Oh, my God.
It's not my worst result at tournaments over the years.
Yeah, well.
It's not my best, but it's not my worst. particularly not having played no games with Tau before that day.
You're a disgrace.
Anyway, With you playing a team event, obviously the missions can certainly impact the hammer and anvil style missions where you're playing.
I do just need to, sorry, people perhaps don't understand my sense of humour. If you come in 10th at a tournament, that's really good and you should be really proud. I am just making fun of Mike, and that's because he's my husband and I'm allowed to, and we've known each other a really long time. But if you come in 10th, or even if you come in 110th, you should still be proud and you are not a disgrace. He's a disgrace. You're not. Okay. There's my little positive message done for the day.
You see the pep talks I get at home, people? Anyway.
When he played in the last time that he played in the, it was ATC then, but now it's ANZTC. They were doing it. I'm like, if you come in any lower than third, don't even bother coming back to the state, let alone home. He brought home second.
Yeah, we finished second.
It's work.
I had a good weekend that weekend in terms of wins.
in terms of being away from me and my pep talks.
So, what were we talking
about? I have no idea. I'm sorry. We were talking about being prepared and for the team, and it's not just about you.
So hammer and anvil deployments can really impact some armies because you're playing short edge to short edge. So you've actually got a 6 foot long table, only 4 feet wide. And that'll obviously change the way that some armies play in their dynamics and how fast you need to be to cover the table to get to objectives. But also long range firepower like the Astra Militarum bring and some tower lists as well can really negatively impact you in terms of matchups. So you have to consider, like, looking through the player's pack, if you know those are coming, how are you going to deal with those missions? How are you going to deploy the objectives? How are you going to get around the table? Or is that going to be a round that the whole team just shrugs and goes, oh, well, we're stuffed?
That's probably not the best way to look at that.
But that's something that should be discussed. I know that a lot of the WATC teams, and certainly the West Australian ANZTC team, have a group chat on Facebook that is constantly pinging.
Constantly pinging.
As the committee rep for WA, I'm in those chats and I tend to get lots and lots of notifications that sit there on silent or do not disturb overnight because it got so bad at one point. It was just ping, 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 ping.
Started to think there was an issue.
So, but having those live conversations with the team so that you can start talking about, hey, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? How do you deal with this type of deployment? How do you go against this sort of army is really important to how the team then sorts out its matchups. And the like I said earlier in the piece, the matchup videos on the YouTube channel, which we'll have a link in the show notes so you can go and check it out.
Yeah.
But the matchup process is probably one of the single biggest complexities, but also the most important parts of pre-game.
Yeah, and we're going to cover that in a minute. But before we do, I guess one of the... And it is linked... One of the things to think about is, I really love cliches, I really don't, but you know, there's the saying, there's no I in team, and it's really
there's an I in win.
There is, you're right. and actually there's a little picture that shows that there can be an I in team, but anyway, it doesn't matter. So when you're playing for the team, you have to put the team before yourself.
Yeah.
So, and acknowledge that there may be times that you get the bad matchup. And it's not about going, oh, well, I'm going to lose this, so and just handing over the 20-0 win to your opponent, but actually trying to pull in back as many points as you possibly can. But being aware that, yeah, there will be times that if everybody else has the potential to get a good matchup in this particular round...
And you take the poor one.
And you take the poor one, well, then you've taken that for the team. And this is why we actually don't include the WATC in our rankings.
Yeah.
Because we do really understand that people, you have to take the bad matchups for the benefit of the team.
Yeah. I remember in the last ATC, ANZTC, in 2016 I played, there was a Grey Knight army that everyone looked at and went, oh, I don't really want to play that. And I had my Necron army in 7th edition, which was as durable as any. And it was one I still didn't think I was going to win, but through a combination of careful deployment, 2 bad psychic tests on his behalf and 1 decent charge, I won that 20-0, almost tabled him. And then later in the event I played a Tau army, which was multiple optimized stealth cadres from Queensland, which again we'd finished day one as a team. We went back to one of the hotel rooms and we're kind of going through the next day's list, having a look at what we were going to be dealing with, and we were talking about this particular Tau build that just everyone went, oh god, this is horrific, what do we do? And then someone in the room said, what does it do to you, Mike? And we all went, oh, it's bad, it's bad. Oh, hang on a minute. It actually does nothing because it doesn't threaten me in any way, shape or form. And I've got 3 times as many bodies And so while I didn't kill a great deal that game, I just zoned out most of the table so he couldn't claim the objectives, and I won at 18-2. So sometimes you just have to look at the perspective of the event of and try and get those matchups that either no one else wants to take them away from the other.
Yeah, to give people, I guess, to give the other teammates the chance of getting a better win.
Yeah, but also thinking about how you can turn those poor matchups into something where you will get points and you will score points out of them by careful deployment or, you know, specific reserve strategies and those sorts
hiding.
Of things.
Running and hiding is a completely effective
yeah, well, a lot of our strategy. Terrain, a lot of our terrain now is line of sight blocking. So
you know
it
what?
Should get easier.
You hide and they can't kill you. You'll still be there at the end of the game. You'll get some points.
Well, you might get some points. It depends on what you've been scoring.
You might, yeah. And which does come into the next point, which is about risk-taking and how you need to consider the kinds of risks that you're prepared to take, given that it's not just about you, it's about the team as a whole.
Look, my tower charged an Imperial Guard gun line on the weekend. No one charges tower with anything. Well, no one charges anything with tower, I should say. I think that's the right way around.
Yes, that made sense.
I did. It was a risk. Got a 20-0, went out of it.
Could have gone the other way. And you could have carved it.
I'm good enough. I knew. It's fine. Yeah. No, those sorts of risks, again, in a single player format, it's only you have to answer to. And maybe your angry wife. but in a team event, throwing those big risk plays out when you don't need to is a risk that can easily backfire and cost the team a win. If you are the last game going and your captain comes up and says to you, hey, man, like, really, we need you to just go hard. If you don't win this 15-5, we haven't even got a shot at winning the round. At that point, take the risks. Because if you know the team's going to lose without going hard, then just go home.
And same with, you know what, we've won it, do what you can.
Just conserve it and hold it back. Or if the margin of error means that your game doesn't matter, then you can afford to take those risks.
That's what I mean. Because if you, you know, if you do take the risks, then you've got the potential of pulling in some extra points.
Yeah, for countbacks and things.
Yeah.
So you certainly, the captain's role in all of this has to be liaison with the team, and we'll cover that a little bit later on, but the captain becomes quite crucial in that regard as to how the team plays out on the day.
Yeah, and as we've been saying, so we have 20 points available for each, you've got 20 points available for each game, so that's 120 points for each round across your team of six players. So you actually only need to get 66 points in order to win the round.
Yeah, so 55 to 65 is a draw, and then 54 to 66 is the win-loss.
Mm-hmm.
So you only need 66 points, you've got six players, that's 11 points a player.
Yeah, that's it. So if you're aiming for 11 points a player, that seems a lot more doable than trying to go out and get 6 20-zip wins. But at the same...
Particularly since you can get 6 20-zip wins and then still not win the round if you get 6 20-zips in return. Yeah. And all of a sudden you end up in a draw.
Yeah. So my point was that if you do, you know, if you are the player that gets the really bad matchup and you're, you know, you're really unlikely to win the game, you're still aiming to get a couple of points. But if you lose, say, 14-6, then that's only an extra point that each of your opponents need to get in order to still pull that whole team through to win the round.
It's also six less points than that your opponents lose from their overall score, which means that they have to work that a little bit harder if you have another swingy game somewhere else on the team. We had that the first two games in the final round in 2016 in Sydney with us. Tom went 20-0, I went 20-0. The third game was 10-all draw, so we were 50 points. We needed 86 in the ANZTC format. We had 50 points from the first three games.
So you need 36 over the
points
other
from five games, and we're going,
shouldn't be too tricky.
We actually have a decent shot at this. And then we had a 20-0 against us come in. It was like, oh, that's not great. And then we had another one come in, okay. And we lost it. It was only by a handful of points. I think the final game was playing. We needed 7 for a draw, 17 for a win. And for the winning of the round, that is.
Yeah.
The player in question, I went to Jake. And I still remember this because he's a bastard for doing it. Jake, you need 17 points for a win. it doesn't matter if we draw the round. We would have come second. We had to win the round to get first overall.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, just go. Do what you need to do. Go for it. Take the risks. And there's nothing ventured, nothing gained. 17 points is the goal. Go. And he came up to me as the timer ran out and went, hey, Mike, got 17-3. And I went, what? Are you kidding me? How the... did you manage that? And I don't know, 17-3 loss. And I went, oh, screw you, Jake. I had that brief moment of,
we
oh my
did
God,
it!
How the hell did you do that? Because that didn't look good when I said that to him.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, I was right. So, But there was that brief moment in my head where I went, how the hell did he pull that off?
So with the ATC, ANZTC compared to the WATC, you still... with both of them, you still only need the 11...
It's essentially 11 points. 11 points. If you get 6 or 8 wins, no matter what the margin, if it's a win, you win the round.
What I'm saying is you need 11 points per player in order to win the round at the lowest possible margin. But if somebody loses in the ATC, you've obviously got more of a buffer with your other players in order to...
pull back those points.
Yeah, whereas in WATC, with only the 6 players, that's one of the downsides to having lower number of players, is that you don't have as many players in order to spread the load over.
Yeah, if your first 2 games are 20-0 losses in the round, then you've got a lot of...
Your other 4 players
have
need
to really go well.
Yeah, in order to actually pull out the win. But it's definitely possible. You know, if you get 3 players with a 20-zip win... you're at 60 already. Your other 3 players need to get 6 points between them.
Well, you essentially need 17 points a player if you go over 4 players if you go 2 20-0 losses and 3 wins.
So there's lots of different ways that you can get that win.
Yeah. Oh, obviously, as soon as you put a 20 into that mix, then the other numbers come down. And
yeah, which comes down to, I guess, how prepared you are as a team. We've seen a lot of different ways that teams do actually prepare for their... for how they're going to do the matchups.
Yeah, when I first started going to the ANZTC, we were essentially using a traffic light. So red if it was a terrible matchup, yellow if it was an okay matchup, and green if it was a good one.
And this is all done pre-event.
Yeah,
so you get all the
lists are released a couple of weeks in advance.
And then you can sit down with your list versus the list from all of the other players for all the other states. And go, I can take this guy, no, I can't. I'm saying guy because so far we haven't had a female player at the ANZTC.
No,
I don't believe.
Not at the ANZ one.
So, however, hopefully we will have some for the...
Well, we've got head females at the WATC.
Yes, most definitely.
And we've got a ringer team put together for the ANZTC for 2018 in the event we have...
co-captained by a female.
It is. Ghislaine, who played our first game on YouTube, is co-captaining with Matt Bell, who's an ex-ANZTC player as well.
Matt's the boy.
Yep. So the Merc team is preparing as if they're going to play, as if they are competing and doing all the same things. It's great prep for them to get used to playing in that format, and it brings another 8 players from WA up to a standard that matches the rest of the country in terms of the team event.
Yeah.
So that's really good for them.
So I went off on a little tangent there about gender equality and the fact I was using the word guy. So apologies, I will pull it back. So in the lead up to the event, yes, it's going through and saying, I think I'm guaranteed a win against this player. This one, oh, I'm not sure. This is definitely a no. And using that traffic light system.
We tried that, and the problem with that is you've got no surety on how many points you think you can score. So the next year, we started talking about scoring, and then someone introduced an orange to the traffic light, and someone else introduced like a lime green to the traffic light.
So when I went to school, we called that a Likert scale. However, Mike called it an extended traffic light. Red, orange, yellow, lime green, green.
Yeah.
But, you know, it all works.
It's a thing. I don't know.
So red is definitely not going to win.
Orange is probably not going to win. Yellow is, eh. Lime green was, yeah, probably win that. And green was, I'm definitely going to win that.
Yeah.
And then that still doesn't give you, as a captain, speaking from my experience at least, it didn't give me enough information. Because if you go to a player, what tended to happen was the players were all picking oranges, yellows and lime.
Yeah.
And not being willing to commit to how well they thought they could actually do, which meant that as a captain, you're looking at the matchup sheet going, who do I put against that? Because you've got all four of you bastards are yellow or lime green. Like, that doesn't mean anything to me. So for 2016, and we might have even done it for 2015, but we started allocating scores. And they are arbitrary scores on what you think you might score against them, whether it's 15-5 or 20-0 or 12-8 or whatever it happens to be. But it means that you as a captain go, okay, cool. When you say you're going to lose that, you're going to lose that 15-5. You're not going to lose it 20-0. Mm. No, I think I'll score some points. Okay, cool. So that when you're actually going through your matchup sheet trying to figure out who you want to play what,
you can work out how you can get your 66 points.
Yeah, and the more experienced players, like when we were talking about it post 2016, we actually looked at all the predicted scores versus the actual scores, and most of us were pretty close.
Yeah.
Because obviously the more experience you get, particularly in different sort of formats.
There's always going to be times where you have, you know, yeah, the dice are just really not on your side. Or
the flip side of it. I mean, that game against the Grey Knights with my Necrons, I think, yeah, I had that down as a 15-5 loss and ended up with a 20-0 win.
Yeah. Stuff happens.
Yeah.
But when you're able to, you know, when you practice, well practiced with your army, and you're able to make informed decisions and make an informed estimation as to how many points you're likely to score.
There's some guys who are just more analytical than others. It's whether it's their job or whether it's the way they're brought up or whether it's just their human nature.
Yep.
Jake from Bunbury, he's an amazing analyst in terms of all those scores, and he's very accurate, and he's great for that sort of stuff for the ANZWA team. So, you know, he's very accurate in that regard. I have less data driven to the way I pilot things, but I can make them work.
Mm.
So, you know, ultimately it'll come down to how you play and how well-versed you are against some armies as well.
And what knowledge you've got to draw on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and using, I guess, being able to use those pre-planned matrices in order to make informed decisions when you're going into that matchup process.
Yeah.
And knowing that if your team, you know, if the opponent team is putting down a list X, then you know that your list A and D are going to be your best possible options against that based on the matrix that you've done, rather than just winging it.
Yeah, and part of the trick with that, though, is as well is not just thinking about the round that you've got now, but also the rounds you've got coming up to match up.
Yeah, definitely.
Because if you look at your first one and you go, okay, well, everyone can play that. Well, that doesn't mean you should just pick whoever. You should be looking at who's got... If everyone can play it, then you pick the two players that have the worst matchups other than this one and put them up first. Mm-hmm. Because then you're giving one of your players who's probably going to have a harder time against everyone else a good game. So sometimes you've actually got to work backwards to figure out who you actually want at the start.
Yep, definitely. And same with, you know, if you've got if your opposing army is one that no one's going to do well at, don't just pick anyone. Pick the person who's least likely to get a good matchup
somewhere else. Yeah,
and
if they're going to
throw them under the bus,
yeah. If they're going to lose,
that's it.
You might as well take a bad matchup for the rest of the team.
Better off to have one game loss rather than potentially two.
Yeah, absolutely. The strategy around the matchup process is something that comes with experience. I've done it 3 times at the ANZ level. The first time around, I was naive and thought I had it under control and didn't. The second year, I got the matchups right, according to the numbers that we'd all predicted, but we didn't deliver. The third year, Jake got involved quite heavily with all his analytics, and between his analytics and my gut, we ended up finishing second. So I suppose that process of second-guessing your opponents and figuring out, if I was in their shoes, what would I be doing?
Yeah.
It also plays a part. And I suppose the advantage, though, at the ANZ level is that a lot of those high-end players, you kind of get to know by going to the events, so you can mm-hmm. kind of second-guess what they're thinking, which is how we got the Tau Necron game that we really wanted in 2016, because we second-guessed
what their
captain was going to do.
Yeah.
And we were right.
Yeah.
Didn't win us the round, but we were right. So.
But that's one of the other things to cover is... the role of the captain on the day, which is obviously, you know, their role is in the matchup process. They are not actually allowed to coach their team members.
No, not at all.
Regardless of whether that's a playing coach or a non-playing coach, there's no coaching allowed to go on during the actual event.
And that applies across both the all three of the formats we're talking about mm-hmm. today.
But what they can do is go up and go, how are you going? How many points are you likely to get? We only need X number of points. Or, you know what? Go for broke. Your score's not going to make any difference.
Can I add here, as a captain, going up and saying, how's the game going? And you going, yeah, right, is not
really
friggin'
not helpful.
It's not conducive to my blood pressure, and it's not nice to hear. So my suggestion for any captains out there, or for players who actually want to be considerate of their captain's well-being, when the question is posed, either pose it as, what's the score?
Or what do you think the intended score is?
What do you think the final score is going to be? Or if the captain asks, how's it going? Then answer that with, I think I'm going to end up with a 12-8 win.
Yeah.
Or I think I'm going to lose.
Well, don't just say, I think I'm going to end up with a 12-8 win. I think this final score will be this.
No, say 12-8 win. If you think that's going to happen.
Yeah, if you think it's going to happen, don't just make don't that just, your standard response regardless 12-8 win, of what 12-8 you think.
No, as a captain, it just means then that once you've... when I've done it the last time, I basically, at the end of my turn one, I would say to my opponent, you start your turn two, or I'd have my turn two and then let them start their turn two. So around that sort of 45 minutes into the game, hopefully, I'd do one quick round and sort of go, how's everyone, like, what is everyone going? How are we looking for points? I'd go back again probably at the hour and a half mark or as soon as the first game ended. Either of those is the key point, because then you know where you're starting from. And then you can go to the rest of the team and go, cool, we've had one game finished, we won that 18-2. It looks like we're going to run the round, keep doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sort of information can help inform the players' choices.
And it helps you decide what kind of risks are appropriate to take as well.
So, and like I did with Jake in that final round with Queensland, I'd already got all the scores in, worked out what we needed, and just went, go for it, man. Like, do whatever you want to do. And sometimes that sort of thing pays off and sometimes it doesn't.
I think we've jabbered on longer than we were supposed to for this particular topic.
Only a little
bit. So should we call that the end of the topic there?
Look, there's plenty more to discuss. If you've got anything else you want us to answer, shoot them through on the email. But we'll be back in a second to wrap up the episode. Right, so that was an hour of Team 40K chat, and it was a lot of information to digest in a very short period of time.
It was a lot of information, and I do just want to say, I feel like we made that sound really, really complicated with the whole matchup process and the thought process that goes behind it and all the different things that everybody needs to think about. Our intention really wasn't to try and scare you off attending team events. If you want to rock up to WATC with six mates or five mates and just wing it on the day, that is...
Plenty of the teams do that.
Yeah. And, you know, some of them do well, some of them do less well. But some of the analytic teams do less well as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, it comes back to expectation. If you're going to win the event, if you and your team genuinely want to go along, compete and aim to win the event, then the more prep and practice you put in, the better your chances are.
Yeah.
If you turn up on the day with five friends, with armies that you threw together because that's what you own, and then you don't win the event and are disappointed, then...
Well, here's some things that you can look at for next year to try and improve your chances. And our basic aim is to try and offer as much information as possible so that people who are listening to this can learn from it and can hopefully use it to help them make decisions.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's up to you how much of it you listen to and how much of it you just go, that's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully, though, it's given you some insight into how I've prepped for some of the team events over the years and some of the stuff that goes in behind the scenes for some of the high-end teams that go to ETC and obviously the ANZ format as well. If you've got any questions, you're more than welcome to email them through to us or jump on the contacts page on the website or jump on Facebook or however you want to get in touch. And
carrier pigeon.
No, don't do carrier pigeons. True. I have the dogs around the backyard chasing it for days. If you want to get in touch, though, ask the questions. Do them before the event. Don't wait until the day.
Yeah.
And we've got some really active players at the moment who are asking those questions and seeking feedback, which is great. We're more than happy to answer those questions. So, follow all the usual links to get in touch with us. But I think that's us done for today. So I'm now going to go and start the very lengthy edit process.
Hopefully it'll be done by Wednesday.
It'll be done by Wednesday. Yeah. It'll be fine. So thank you very much for listening, guys and girls, hopefully. Thank you very much, Emma, for joining me again today.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sitting next to me and talking, I guess.
See, this is what I get. This is what I get. All this loveliness, and that's what I get.
What did you want?
Anyway, Oh, very quickly, I'm taking Tao to WATC this year. It's one of our few events I get to play at because Emma TOs it. So anyone who wants to suck up for the TO, you have to talk to Emma, not me. So
I like chocolate.
Not none of that chili chocolate, though. She's she's a fruit and nut or Black Forest
chocolate.
Girl.
Chocolate.
So, so best possible chance for me to get a game in at one of our tournaments is WATC. So if you ever wanted a game against me at a tournament, that's the place to come and do it.
And WATC, it is West Australian Team...
Challenge,
Championship.
Whatever.
We should probably know that. But it is open to people from anywhere.
Yep.
So don't let the fact you don't live in WA stop.
We've got
you.
Another Melbourne boy coming over this year.
I know, it's so exciting.
He comes over and joins the Bunbury team, which is awesome. So, yeah, come along, enjoy the day. If you want to come and spectate, by all means, come down and check it out as well. Emma will be in the bright orange shirt. There'll be team shirts. There'll be... the Purple Cobras are returning again.
Awesome.
It's going to be a great day. And the team I'm on is actually captained by Ghislaine Platel as well. So
oh, yay.
She's our team captain this year. So that's going to be awesome. It's a great opportunity for her to kind of sink her
Have
teeth into it and boss her husband around.
Nice.
So, all right, everyone. Thanks very much for listening. And we'll see you again at the next episode.
Now, I can't make you do it. You got to look at the guy next to you. Look into his eyes. Now, I think you're going to see a guy who will go that inch with you.
Hell yeah.
You're going to see a guy who will sacrifice himself for this team because he knows when it comes down to it, you're going to do the same for him.
Hell yeah.
That's a team, gentlemen.
Hell yeah.
You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us, obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.